The Reverend Kathleen McTeague, former minister of the Unitarian Society of New Haven, writes, "There is no ordinary life." I have an article from an old Irish newspaper, she writes, the Belfast Newsletter, written in 1849. The story tells about the loss of a ship full of immigrants, just as it approached this coast of Canada at the end of its long voyage from Ireland. In the breathless, dramatic prose of its era, the reporter writes, "Late at night, the ship ran into an iceberg with terrific force. The whole of her bows were stove in. And the next moment, the sea was rushing into the hold with the violence of a cataract. About 20 of the passengers managed to reach the deck just before she went down, some of whom jumped onto the ice while others clung to the floating spars. Nine only, however, could be preserved: six men, two women, and a boy. 109 unhappy souls perished." The account ends with the names of those unlikely nine who managed to survive. And among them is the little boy, Patrick McTeague, my grandfather's grandfather. A second cousin unearthed the article in Ireland and sent it around to family members. We had always heard the tale that there was a shipwreck in our past, but by this time it had reached my father's generation. It was told with a dubious tone and no details. Maybe it happened and maybe it didn't. After all, every family likes to think of itself as special, escaping a gruesome fate by the skin of its collective teeth. When I was in seminary, I heard a similar miracle story. I was working at Rus-Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital in Chicago, doing what is called clinical pastoral education. It's where you work as an intern chaplain and learn how to do pastoral with people in crisis and those with long-term illnesses. Each day, you spend some time on one of the hospital floors, and then you spend some time, several days a week, in individual supervision, in group process, and in classes, learning more about how to care for people. I was assigned to general floors, but spent a good deal of my time in the neonatal intensive care unit because I was baby cursed. Every single time I was on call, which was about once a week to every 10 days, I spent the night at the hospital available for any pastoral care emergency. And every single time I was on call, at least two babies died. I was the only chaplain this happened to, and I got the reputation as the baby death chaplain. One of our classes was led by a local rabbi who instructed my cohort and me on Jewish death rituals. He began his teachings by telling us he knew there was a God. As everyone but I was Christian, no one questioned his statement. He went on to say that there was a grand plan for everyone. At this, I spoke up and asked him, "How could you be so sure?" He told this story. When he was a child in Germany, the Nazis made all the Jewish people wear stars to identify them. His father had fought in World War I, and as they began rounding up Jews and sending them to the ghettos, his father was rounded up too. Each time his father showed his papers de detailing his service to Germany, and he was let go. One day, when he was rounded up, one of the SS soldiers told his father that he needed to leave Germany, that this was the last time they would let him go. His father came home and told his wife, son, and daughter to pack up only what was necessary. They were leaving for the airport that day, that moment. He also told his sister and her husband. The six of them went off to the airport. When they arrived, there was only four seats available going to the U.S. All of a sudden, SS soldiers entered the plane and took two of their own off, and the whole family was able to get out of Germany. He said that this was the last plane that allowed Jews to leave Germany. That, Kristen, he said to me, is how I know there is a God and that he's a plan for all of us. I have to admit that I got chills hearing his story. He was a good storyteller and had all of us wrapped up in the drama that the fear that was so real for the Jews at that time and the tenuousness of the situation. Now, I was 26 at this time and would never have questioned his sincerity, but it did cause me to think about where is this divine plan at work, or whether it was luck that all six of these people got out. Although not all Buddhists believe in God, there is a Buddhist story about a man who is the only survivor of a shipwreck. He washes up upon an island and he regains consciousness and begins to pray to God to help him. But no help comes and he goes to sleep on the beach. Each day for three more days, he prays to God to help him, and yet no one comes to help. He loses his faith and stops praying. He decides that if he's going to survive, he needs to build a hut. So he collects wood and grasses and creates a nice home for his use. He eats coconuts and learns how to spearfish. And one day he goes for a walk on the beach. And when he returns, his hut is on fire. The man rages through most of the night at God for abandoning him. And then finally he falls asleep. When he awakes, there's a ship in the waters near the island. He is rescued. While on the ship, he approaches the captain and asks him how they knew he was stranded there. "We saw your distress signal," says the captain. "But I sent out no signal," replies the man. "But we came here after seeing the fire signal," said the captain. The man remembers his burning hut and realizes that this was the sign the captain is referring to. He understood that it was God's plan to get him off the island by setting his hut on fire. He understands that God's plan is bigger than the plan for himself. In Jewish tradition, God's plan is evident in his covenant with the Israelites. As Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11 reads, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future." We see this plan in Exodus as the Israelites' firstborn sons are passed over, while the Egyptian firstborn sons are killed in order to pressure the king to let the Israelites go. God intervenes again and again, parting the Red Sea, allowing the Israelites safe passage, and then crashing the sea down upon the pursuing Egyptian army. It seems to me that in religious history, God shows God's plan through intervention. These interventions show up as miracles, events not thought to be possible to the people experiencing them, and lead to their belief that God has a plan for them. Like the news stories I have heard in different guises about one person out of a dozens whose house is saved from a tornado, or the only person they find under all the rubble after an earthquake has taken hundreds of lives, or the car crash that kills everyone inside except the person in the passenger seat. Have you noticed that God's plan often involves the deaths of many people in order for one person to live? Was the death of those 23 people in the mudslides earlier last year in California part of God's plan? 3 million people died of COVID in 2020. Was that part of God's plan? More than 25,000 people have already died in the war between Hamas and Israel. Is that God's plan? 9 million people die each year of hunger. Is that God's plan? Some Hindus too believe fate is decided by God. Hindu saints have been reading the lines of hands and foreheads to predict the fate of others for thousands of years. But unlike other religious traditions, Hinduism also says that your fate can change according to your work. I found the story about Rishi, which means teacher in ancient times, who had a gurukul, which is a school. There were many students studying in his gurukul. There was one student among them named Panini, and Panini was the weakest student of the gurukul. Once Rishi saw his hand and said, "There is no line of education in your hand. That's why you don't understand anything I teach." Panini asked Rishi, "Which line denotes education?" The Rishi showed him the line which denotes education on his own hand. "See, Panini, this line is not there in your hand." Panini takes a knife and makes a line of education in his hand, as shown by Rishi, by cutting his hand, and then says to Rishi, "See, now I got a line of education." Reportedly, he goes on to become one of the greatest scholars of India. I don't know if there's any truth to this story, but at least Panini had some agency in his life. I know it takes some arrogance on my part, but I confess I don't believe there is a grand plan for my life. I don't believe in a God that intervenes. I don't believe in an anthropomorphic God that has human plans for individuals. I don't believe in that type of God. I do believe in serendipity, the occurrence and development of events by chance in a happy or beneficial way. This is the case in the story of how I ended up working for the Unitarian Universalist Association. I had graduated from college and was working in a warehouse for a children's catalog company. I decided that I would be a social worker and had applied to the Massachusetts Department of Family Welfare Services, as it was called then. I went on an interview and was told I was hired and that I would receive notice about which office I would be placed in soon. 6 months went by without a word. I started reading the want ads again in frustration and came across an employment opportunity to work for the Unitarian Universalist Association in the Office of Worship and Diversity Resources. I went in, interviewed, and was offered the job. Now, when I got home that same day, I had a message on my answer machine saying that I had been placed in the Jamaica Plain office of the DCFS. I declined that offer and went to work for the UUA instead. While working at the UUA, I began preaching in congregations and was encouraged to go to seminary. I applied to Meadville Lombard Theological School and was awarded the Dean Scholar. The then president of the UUA told me that our congregations weren't ready for a young Black woman minister, and yet I was the first Black woman to be called directly out of seminary to one of our churches. Perhaps there was a grand plan, and that's why I wasn't called to DFS office and the job of the UUA opened. But to me, it was serendipity and a lot of luck. I believe in luck. The random chance that something is going to happen to you that could be good or bad. People who win the lottery are just lucky. People who are born into wealthy families are just lucky. People who have parents who love them, support them, nourish them, and give them the resources they need to be healthy, happy adults, well, they're lucky. Yes, there is hard work that is done. Yes, there are reasons some people are stuck in generational cycles of abuse, addiction, mental health issues, but genetics, biology, environment, and circumstance all combine to cause some people to have more bad luck than others. Most of the extraordinary people I know have made their own luck and used it to change their lives and the lives of others. We are lucky to be alive, and even more lucky to live in the United States, as scary as that has been off and on these past several years. I believe we each should have the opportunity to make our lives extraordinary through our own efforts. And by that I mean with a fair access to education and healthcare and caring community, we can live full, productive, caring lives of wonder and grace. As the Reverend Kathleen McTeague writes, there is no ordinary life. The thing is, it always is true for every person, for every family, she writes. If we trace delicate filaments of life back far enough, we will each find a shipwreck, an earthquake, a landslide, a pogrom, war or starvation, an ancestor barely escaped. And there will be close calls and near misses as well. The wartime bullet that spared your grandfather's heart by an inch. The chance meeting on an accidental road that led to your parents' marriage. The lucky moment when their love resulted in the particular pregnancy that led to the specific you. Hundreds of threads connecting, bringing us into life, each unimaginably tenuous and fragile. Nothing about our lives is ordinary, writes McTeague. Held up against the shadows of pathways not taken, countless catastrophes could have snuffed out the spark that led to this beating heart, these wondrous hands. Every life is a gift of grace, fragile, astonishing, unrepeatable. We forget this easily. We swept up in pulse and busyness of our days. We hustle along in our private preoccupations, brows furrowed in concentration, hurrying lest we waste even a minute. But all of the important doings that fill our days pale against your singular being. If we could remember this once in a while, if we could stop and simply marvel at the stupendous luck that has allowed each of us to live, perhaps we would live more gently with one another. Perhaps we would live more kindly and compassionately as one survivor to another.